I'm talking to George and Noreen Little here at their home in, what's the name of the place, Noreen?
Listener Mallard.
And you're married to George here and living here for how many years now?
38 years, just past there in the summer, yeah.
And what was your own name, your maiden name?
My name was Clingan.
And where did you come
from? And I came from just the far side of Newtown Butler. Yeah, towards Derrylee, downland of Derrylee.
From a farming?
From a farming background, yeah.
And what was it like growing up there?
It was grand. We all just mixed together. I mean, our townland yet, everybody was very friendly. I had three brothers, but my father would never have encouraged anybody to farm. So I was probably a huge disappointment marrying a farmer and staying here. My three brothers all left.
Did they
moved away, yeah.
And did they emigrate out of there?
No, they didn't. My eldest brother went to Dublin. He went to the Irish Times and is still working there.
And what's his name?
He's Willie Clingan, okay. Yeah. And then another brother, he joined the police up in Lisburn. And then my third brother went to university over in Scotland, and he works for, he's actually in America at the minute, yeah.
Okay, so the farm now, is it?
Oh, the farm
left
is
the family name and.
Yeah, family name definitely gone. My mother's still alive, and we would put some cattle on it just and keep it ticking along. But like, there is no real future there either.
Yeah,
you know, we're not going to be there.
And when so your brother joined the police force, and did. When during the Troubles,
that would have been about 1976, yeah.
And what when
79, the year we got married, actually, I think he joined the police,
So when all of this started, you were not yet married at that time. But when did it first hit you that, you know, there's trouble?
Well, my father would have been in the B specials. So, but again, as a child, you didn't appreciate that there was a danger. But I think it was just things like I remember the bullocks getting shot over in Derrylee. You know, and that would have been the early 70s. And a few other sort of atrocities around. I remember like Harry Creighton getting shot. And remember going into town, you always had to have somebody sitting in the car, and they put speed ramps outside all the police barracks. You know, that would have all been in our sort of childhood time. But we weren't really afraid or worried in that respect, like.
And and then all the checkpoints started.
Yeah, and the checkpoints in the army, yes, all that came. Yeah. But I suppose my first real thought of danger was, like with George here, he used to maybe leave you home. And there was only one way out of Derrylee, and you always sort of thought, you know, will he be shot that night, or, you know, what'll happen? You didn't even have mobile phones, or you didn't have anything, so you didn't really know. If you didn't hear anything, you assumed all was well. But I do always remember somebody else saying to me, you know, when we were at maybe a UDR gathering, when we were getting married, oh, you're just going to be another one of us, sitting waiting at home and wondering, you know, what has happened and all the rest. And of course it was long after you're married that you realised how true her words were. That's exactly what you were doing, and you had him dead and buried on many occasions when he didn't turn up.
And so explain to me, just being at home at that time, and you had at that time you had a young family, did you?
Well, this is it. I was a teacher, and I worked in OMA at that time, so like that was okay, off you went. But it was when my first child started school that I then had a pattern that I didn't have before. You know, I had a most definite pattern, and I ended up actually leaving her here with George when I left for school in the morning. And that, to me, I couldn't cope with that. Sort of going down the road, you kept thinking, I wonder, is that somebody going to shoot them? Or, you know, because this was a small child, and there was just no other way around that. And that's what made me, I gave up my job then. About 1986, I think I gave up my job. At that stage, I had three children, and my eldest was starting school, and I was most definitely creating a pattern. And I suppose as long as you'd school to go to, you know, you came home every evening, you'd plenty to do, you were busy, you were tired. And then life was suddenly, you know, it was very different. You were at home here all the time. You were going back and forth to the out farm. Then if George hadn't come home, you'd be the one that would be putting those children in the car to go over to see, you know, if he was all right. And, well, most times you found him talking to somebody or whatever. But, yeah. And, of course, it was 1983 that we had the bomb planted in Mullinhorn.
George told me about that. But tell me your experience.
I always remember it because it was a Thursday and it was about a week or so before Alison was born. And on that particular day, it was a lovely, bright day, really nice day. And I remember we never went sort of the same route. We always varied our route. And we'd went round and we'd talked to loads of people and we'd come in through town. And we'd even went away out to the back of Mullinhorn. And you were in Mullinhorn, so you appreciate we're talking about the lane. We'd been away out to the back. And we were just coming back in and it was sort of like twilight. I think I was going to the Mother's Union or something that night. And just as we were reversing back, I mean, I will always remember it. You know, the fish wire and the great big loop, like the big loop. You could really see it, like big 3-inch loop where they had knotted it together. And like that, leaving Mullinhorn that day, I was desperate just to get out of the country. And I knew that if I'd left the country then, there was no way I'd have ever came back. And we went to another house that evening, and George and the other man, Jim, maybe George has given you those sort of details, George and Jim went into the police station, and me and Catherine stayed there. Catherine was only just coming up to 2, about that age, and I was expecting Alison then in a week. And we came home here, and I do remember your James Molyneux and everybody coming here, like really to almost like show his support for us and all the rest of it here. But I would have been just desperate to get away. And initially you kept yourself together and held yourself together all right. But then like a few days after that, you were in pieces. I remember being in town one day and I just could not get out of that car in case anybody would speak to you or ask you anything. You could not bring yourself like enough courage to just get out. So, you know,
It affected you.
Yeah, it really did get to you. But like, I would not have gone looking for medical help. I would not have done any of those things. We just moseyed on and muddled on, and that was it. And they defused the bomb then, I think the next day or so. And like, it just got small press coverings. We didn't push it in any way at all. But at the same time, in the back of your mind, you knew it had to be a neighbour. It had to be somebody pretty near that had, you know, alerted them to how we could be in a target there.
Knew George's...
we had only started
farm to feed the cattle at that evening.
He went there every day at some point in the day. But the particular movement that we were doing at that time, reversing back up, putting silo into the back of the pickup, that bit of silo had only been sort of opened like within days. So, you know, they'd spotted that. They knew that George had to reverse back in there to fill the silo. And if they didn't get him one day, they were going to get him the next day. You know, it was going to happen. But it was just amazing. And I really do. It really did, I suppose, renew our faith in God. The fact that that sunlight just shone on that wire and showed it up so clearly that day that we didn't break the wire. But I do remember coming out that lane and saying, I need out of here. I don't want to be here anymore. And I suppose that's what we did do for a while. We started looking for, you know, for places like in Scotland or whatever. But we didn't. Went over and visited a few places, but we never actually moved as such. Like, it was going to be just a huge move. And, well, you just didn't know what to do, really.
Did that leave you... and George then more alert and that you were just watching every move. I know you were doing it prior to it, but more so.
It really shattered your life in a way that if there was nobody, like families that weren't involved in security forces, you know, it's almost like as if they didn't even want to be part of you, you know, or to be places with you. You know, you really felt, you know, how do I belong in this? And yet you had to keep some sort of normality going, like for your family's sake. Like, I remember one woman who really hurt me, down there in that street. And I remember her words to me were, just think of the compensation you would have got. You know, it was like, it was just so, and I thought to myself, oh, don't forget now, we're all going to be gone here. Do you know? Yeah. And I just had to walk in and just leave it at that. You just couldn't, you know, how people thought about it all. But I suppose you just struggled on, and yet the UDR didn't even bring in that much income, but yet had ruined your life in such a way.
But what I can't understand is that they that somebody local who would know you and know you very well would spot the opportunity and do it.
Yeah.
So would you look over your shoulder then and think, oh, was it him?
Yeah,
or was it her?
You definitely did. You definitely doubted people. And you would be less... I wouldn't have never been a bitter person. And I mean, I've tried to bring my children up, but they're not bitter. But at the same time, you knew that somebody somewhere had to, you know, as you say, point the finger there. There's the chance. There's the opportunity. And it's one thing I would love to do is to find out, you know, what did the police do? Because nobody gave you any information whatsoever. You know, who had they questioned? What had they found out? Nobody came forward with anything.
But surely the police would have would have asked you about the, you know, the situation, or did they? Or
no,
you know,
no, I don't remember. I don't remember ever any questioning at all.
Okay,
or
so
any
follow up
from them. No, we would have never got any report whatsoever. What happened there? So you're kind of left in that doubt.
Yeah.
But I suppose you had to kind of just move on with life. And I suppose the only real freedom was when we maybe got away. We'd be away for a week or 10 days or whatever. We used to go over to Scotland or somewhere like that, and we'd bring the tent with us. And you really felt safe, you know, when you got out of this country, when you got on the boat. And I still think that, and I got onto the boat going anywhere. I'm away, I'm safe, you know.
Yeah.
And yet I don't feel any fear living here now.
Yeah.
I used to sometimes bring the children myself, and we'd go. George used to have a man that worked with him, Russell. He was a sort of an elder. Oh, well, I used to think he was elderly, but he was in his 50s or so. But at that time, I thought he was. Yeah. And I used to bring them over their dinner, and then we'd be away, to maybe we'd go to the seaside, we'd go to, you know, to down to Donegal or somewhere like that. But and we tried to live just as normal a life as we could. But, it wasn't. It was a funny life to live at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And but, just any kind of change or disturbance or, say, at night time, a noise or something like that.
Outside. That would have been the thing. Like, George would have been out here in duty, and your children were small, so they all went away to bed. Like, they were away to bed, 7:30 or whatever time of night it was. And, you know, you'd be sitting here. And I remember I used to knit at night, and you'd be knitting your ball of wool, or you'd be doing whatever you'd be doing. And I do remember on several occasions, where you really would be afraid.
Yeah.
But you weren't so much afraid. I was never really afraid for myself. I was more afraid now when George comes home. I remember one night you could hear the rustling around the street. And, of course, the next morning it was only a wee lid, of a margarine tub or something. But, you know, it blew this direction and blew that direction. But, you know, there you were. You're going snooping about. And I remember another night maybe going out, and then you began to think, has somebody came in when I'd been out? You know, because you'd went out and left the door open. And there was another time that I did actually alert them, because George had travelled with somebody else that night, and I could just visualise them both being shot. And I'd heard a door slide. I'd been in bed, but I'd most definitely heard a door slide. And I got up and looked and poked and couldn't hear anything. And I remember ringing in to, you know, the UDR place at the centre at that time, just to say that I thought that there was something. And I remember they did send out a patrol and everything else. But somebody had obviously been looking maybe for a patrol or looking for somebody else. And I would often leave our light on, whether we were here or whether we weren't, you know. And they'd obviously thought maybe there's somebody still up down there, and they'd went down here, and was their van door had been, you know. So eventually you got that solved. And then there was another time This would have been, I think Andrew might have been a child at this time, so this would have been the early 90s. We have six children. It was June time, which is always like, was always a lovely time of the year, the children getting their holidays, and you know, when I was working, you were getting off and everything was great. I remember coming back home and getting stopped by the army down there at the cross, you know, and I said, I just live up there, you know, I have to get home, I have to get home. I think I'd maybe been away getting a part or something for you. And came back up here to the cross, the same thing, who are you, where are you going? And like, I really thought, this is it, you know, George is shot this time. What's all these security, you know, doing around our house? And, you know, with a lot to do, they let you back in. You know, you almost insisted, look, these are my children, I had six children in the car, I need in, I need home, I need to get back in again. And eventually they let you in. But at that time, they wanted George to kind of move to, you know, a safe house or something. But of course, being a farmer, I mean, that wasn't on. Yeah. They wanted to move us to Oma or somewhere at that time.
And but so probably there was just that's something
no
you
way.
Would...
Yeah. No. Well, we couldn't have done that. Other people at that time used to have maybe a bit of security around their yard. Mm-hmm. And they'd come in, maybe live in one of the outhouses or whatever, and kind of, but George again rejected all that. And to me, I seen all that as sort of, you know, a bit of security or whatever.
Of course, yeah. To see the checkpoints down the road.
You'd have felt
that,
a bit safer, yeah, if you would have had somebody like that. But, yeah, the police used to do, there used to be like a police patrol that they called the Pixies. Maybe people have told you about them, have they? And, I mean, you got to know the most of them. And they would sometimes have been accompanied with soldiers. And they'd have maybe come by and, you know, be here for a wee while and then move on again.
Yeah.
But you really just had to kind of, trust it all would be all right, because there was no way, there was nothing else for it. And as I said before, you really didn't have any sympathy from people who weren't involved, you know.
And so does that mean that up in the hill here or next door that your Catholic neighbour, you couldn't trust that person or you couldn't?
I suppose we just didn't have much to do with them at that time. Simply because they were around. And you wouldn't, you would have spoken to them, but you would have never confided in them. Yeah. And you'd have never, and even to this day, you know, people often would say to me, you know, why do you never say things? Or why do you never just say where you're going or what you're doing? I wouldn't.
So
if I was going away, like, say we were going away for a week, you know, you might just say, well, you know, we'll not be there or whatever. But like, you don't, maybe you're not as open with anybody, Protestant or Catholic, maybe as you should be.
Well, that's, I'm that's sure just that's a habit what that 30 just, years would do to you.
Yeah, that's
of,
a habit.
Of being
yeah.
careful mm. and not saying too much and being quiet. Was that something that, imagine living like that, you know, with your head down and staying quiet and not being able to, being careful of what you say.
Yeah, you'd be careful of what you'd say. But we'd have gone, and because you had children, I don't know what it would have been like if you'd had no children. Because you had children, you were still extremely busy because you were bringing them to things and you were going to things. But the whole burden of that then was obviously on me, because George couldn't have a pattern. I mean, we know examples of where maybe other UDR men would have left their children to something or whatever, and that's when they would have been shot. So I kind of like really took responsibility for, you know, bringing children everywhere they were going and doing all the runs and doing all sorts of nonsensical things, you know. Like I remember going to Enniskillen. Yeah. I know when you look back on it, if anybody else had said to you that had done this, you'd have said, oh, you're mad. But, you know, you'd have left a child. Catherine used to be in the Ardoan band or something in Enniskillen. You'd have left her at Enniskillen. You'd have come back home and then everybody would have been in bed and you'd have went back. And you wouldn't have, because you wouldn't have involved anybody else in that, really, you know. So you were kind of, you just kept going for the sake of going, and trying to keep your children going and hoping that they would have, you know, a better future.
So how did, you had six children and how did they all turn out?
Oh, yeah. Our children have all, I mean, I've enjoyed having my children. But I think the best, I can still remember, like when we heard about the ceasefire and more or less all been over. It was the most it was a wonderful feeling. It was a really good feeling that that was over, mm-hmm. you know, and that was the early 90s, that there was supposed to be peace and that it was all over. Even when they called the ceasefire at Christmas,
yes.
you kind of felt as if something had lifted off you, you know.
And was there that release
most definitely.
What would you call it? Weight on your shoulder.
Yeah, most definitely. Like, George talked there about going to Cork. But I remember one time we went, and this was a family just kind of connecting up together again. And I remember we went to Cork, and we went with my brother who was on the police. And we drove up to Lisburn from here and then drove to Cork. So you were crossing the border where you were completely unknown. So that nobody was sitting there watching you cross the border. You know, here in like Clonus or Waterbridge or anywhere like that.
So you had to do a kind of big detour.
I remember us going that time. We went down there and we all met up. And
What year was that? After
the... Remember we went down. No, this would have been while the Troubles were on.
Mm.
Because I remember thinking, like, Cork, you know, how lovely it is, you know, no troubles here. And then I remember seeing IRA wrote on the wall, you know, like the graffiti. I was thinking, it's not far away, no matter where you go.
Imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you must feel that everybody down south is somebody who is supporting or...
I suppose you did kind of look at it like that. And yet there's many well-meaning people down there too, and it wasn't a bit like that at all. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that's how you just assumed that you were in danger, really. You felt safer when you were back in the north again and back across the border.
Mm. Mm. And so that way of life, it has left its mark, has it?
Oh, it has most definitely left its mark. Like, I would have never left work or anything, only I didn't feel as if I had a choice. And yet when you look back, you think to yourself, I'm sure lots of people would have maybe taken off work or would have broke down. But for your own family, the only way I could see to keep things going for them was to try to maintain some sort of normality and, you know, try and keep going. So I would have then maybe gone back to work. I suppose the peace really would have been, you know, would have been here, really. I would have, we're always worked a wee bit of time, you know, odd weeks and things, and maybe a maternity leave or something like that. But I would have never had a strict regular pattern again. Yeah. You know, that created a terrible regular pattern for your children. But then I would have went back to work then in the 90s again.
I see.
You see, yeah, worked up until just a year or so ago.
What were you teaching?
I was teaching home economics, yeah. And I went back then to work in Fibnall Town. But it worked in all right, because really my children would have been away to school by the time I was leaving, and, you know, and then George would have been here when they came home.
Yes.
And whereas you couldn't have done that in the Troubles. You couldn't have had your children coming home, and, you know, I couldn't have had George here, you know, because he tried not to have a pattern.
Yeah.
Mm.
Noreen, it's an amazing story. Yeah. It really is. The more I hear and these stories, and the
Yet the army, like, I have pictures of the army here. Some of the, at that time, you'd have seen them nearly as some of your best friends. And to be fair, I don't remember a single name of one of them. But somewhere I have photographs of them. They used to come there in the summer holidays and they'd be playing around the streets with the children. And they come here from, and I can still remember them coming. There were Scottish soldiers. I can sort of visualise their uniform. And I remember them coming and hugging me and saying, we're away, we're gone, you know. And they'd made the helicopter bring them round and drop them, and they run up here to say goodbye. And they were all, like, when I look now at my children, when they went through, they were only 18, 20, you know, young soldiers.
Yeah.
And, like, even if any of them were killed, you really, like, you know, you were thinking of, it really was like a war to some extent. It really was, from our point of view.
And just on that, just talking about your point of view, was there a sense, though, you had the B specials, you had the British Army, and you had the UDR. Could it have been over policed, maybe, or did it need that amount of policing, do you think?
Well, I really felt that no matter what they'd done, they couldn't. It would have been so much easier if you'd have been on the other side, where you could work in secret, where literally, you know, it was just that little group before, so I don't know how many was in an IRA group or whatever. But like, they could pick their moment. So you could never really relax because you didn't know whether it was going to be morning, noon or night. You didn't know when your attack might come. And it was easier for them, whereas for, I suppose, the others, the presence had to be felt. And
yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, not all British soldiers or English, Scottish, whatever they were, they weren't all nice and friendly. They weren't. You know, like, say, for example, that those ones you got to know, those ones, when you met them at a checkpoint, you knew them. They were nice. They were. It was great. But then new crowd come in, didn't know who you were, you know. They were gruff. They were. You hated even going through checkpoints and things. Like, you didn't like that either. But, sure, you couldn't go anywhere if you weren't prepared to go through a checkpoint.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Again, I think it's important, though, that I learn, or I ask these questions, because then I understand better what. Yeah.
But
what
I do it think it was easier for people on the other side. Mm. Now, if you know what I mean, I often thought it would be, and even yet, I feel that they have maybe a better support network, like, than we would have as such. You know, they stood together much better and supported each other much better. Than maybe we did. Definitely there was like a bit of a division between those that were involved in the security forces and those that weren't on the Protestant side.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I really felt that from people around me. I did.
We'll have to put it all together. We'll have to put it together. Mm. Noreen, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you, George, for inviting me into your house to talk to Noreen. Thanks.
I was just saying, if George had told me that you were coming just to talk to me today, I'd have been gone to my bed.
Thanks.
Yeah. We don't talk much about it, really. Yeah. No, we don't. Yeah. But you do feel as if it has sort of ruined your life and ruined.
Yeah. But unless you talk about it, we'll never know. You know, it's important that that we leave these memories for our children to understand more about it.
And like, I doubt, I don't think my children have grown up bitter. I really don't. I think they're friends on both sides, and, you know, hopefully they're not too impacted like by it all. And I mean, they have all gone on and done well for themselves, and hopefully, but having said that, they're not here. They've left.
I know. Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Noreen. Yeah. Thanks.